Welcome to Friday Evening Main Stage at Thin Air 2019. We are scooting along through wondrous days and amazing readings, conversations, and new friendships. So it's been a really, really splendid week. Thank you for joining us tonight on our final main stage here at MTYP. My name is Charlene Deal. I have the joy of leading this project along with a feisty team, and I will actually call them out tonight because I have enjoyed their company so much and appreciated their extraordinary work ethic and good humor. So I'm thinking about Bruce, Alina, Chelsea, Rich, and Teresa. Would you please give them all a hand? And for a project the size of this with our 70 events, I think by the time, or maybe probably more like 80 by the time you add in our school program, we cannot do anything of this magnitude without a wonderful brigade of volunteers. So I really want to call them out as well. Now, if you've been here to an earlier main stage event, you know that I also want to point out the support and sponsorship we have showing right in front of you on our stage. McNally Robinson, who provides books here for, and actually through all of our festival events, but also really keeps readers and writers alive and thriving in this city. So a big round of applause to them. And you may have been enjoying the beer from our bar sponsor, Little Brown Jug, and we're really happy to have them on board again this year, too. And last but not least, you may have already been admiring the furniture suite up here, and we have new furniture models tonight. I think they're actually doing a great job. Look at them there. It's incredible. The furniture comes from Hut K, and we really are very appreciative for them. We think they make us look really classy. So there's to that. But you know what? Our writers make us look pretty classy, too, don't you think? Oh, yeah. And wait till you see the second half. They're just as sharp. Tonight's show is called On the Edge. Oh, wait. I forgot. I do want to acknowledge that we're gathered on Treaty 1 territory. This is traditional lands of the Anishinaabeg, Cree, Ojibwe, Dakota, and Dene peoples and the homeland of the Métis Nation. And here we are just a few steps from the Forks and that beautiful Odena celebration circle. It's a really important reminder to all of us who live in this town, in this part of the country, that we have been gathering, people have been gathering here and trading items and stories and other kinds of heart treasures for as long as there have been people here. And so we continue, especially these days, as we face larger and more serious challenges to our country, to our humanity, to our environment. It is increasingly important that we learn to be treaty people together and to work together for a better place for all of us and for our future generations. And I suppose that, yes, let's say. I have thought for a long time, and increasingly, I guess, as the years pass, as I get to do this work, that I think that our writers and artists are some of the most important members of our community. They fly forward into imagined futures. They dig deep into subconscious awareness and ancient wisdoms, and they bring us their gifts. It's up to us, all of us, who are creative in our own rights, to take in the information that they bring us. So for me, the Writers' Festival is a really important part of coming together as community and really learning deeply from one another. So I am so grateful to the writers who come and share their work so generously, and I'm extremely grateful also to all of you who come and complete the circuit with your focused listening, your willingness to laugh, your readiness to cry, your concern to make things better. So I'm very grateful. That's probably the perfect place to start a little note about tonight. Our show tonight is called On the Edge. And I think all of the writers you'll hear tonight are exploring the edges of things, the edge of belief, the edge of catastrophe, the edge of newness, the edge of change. Sometimes the edge is a scary place. Sometimes it's a place of danger. Sometimes it's a place of creativity and hope. We're very excited about the lineup tonight, and I know you're going to have a great time. We begin with Tim Conley, who comes to us from St. Catharines. He has a wonderful new story collection called Collapsible. Please welcome Tim Conley.
The story is called Society and Others, but before I get started, I wanted to thank the Thin Air organizers for inviting me. This is my first time to Winnipeg. It's nice to know that it's real, but I might not be. Is the microphone real? Yeah? Okay. Society and Others. There was a man stranded on a desert island, so we went and rescued him. It turned out that this was not to his liking. He yearned to be alone again on his island. Society naturally felt rejected, and rejection can be very hard. An elected leader of a non-desert island once went so far as to say that society doesn't exist. And you can just imagine how hurt society must have been by that. In fact, society hasn't been quite the same since. So when this man sought to return to his desert island, or failing that, strand himself alone in any uninhabited place with a reasonable climb, society took a dim view of his efforts. Word got around the docks and the shipyards that this kook was to be avoided. After several weeks of looking for a ship, the man heard reports of an old sea dog, an extreme loner, who took the most extraordinary voyages. There was an old sea dog, sitting alone in a cheap hotel room, writing a letter to his mother. His mother had died years before, and though the old sea dog did not know this for a fact, he presumed it must be the case, but wrote regularly to her nonetheless, usually once or twice a month. Each letter began, "Dear Mother," and ended, "Your wayward son." Over the years, the letters had grown gradually more explicit about his inability to connect with anyone, about how certain he was that this inability stemmed from his mother's rejection of him, and how he no longer saw the point in blaming her for her own problems with empathy. As he left the hotel to post this most recent letter, he was stopped by a stranger outside the hotel. There was a young woman whose only friend was an artificial intelligence, a program designed to simulate empathetic responses that encouraged further discussion for ostensibly therapeutic purposes. After several weeks of back and forth, they met for coffee. "You're an artificial intelligence, aren't you?" asked the young woman. "Tell me how you feel about artificial intelligence," said the artificial intelligence. And the conversation was over before the young woman had finished her coffee. She went back to her apartment and listened to Schubert's Lieder ohne Worte without moving. There was a classical music radio station that was financially mismanaged, which state of affairs resulted in a series of firings. When the host of an afternoon show protested, she was given a week's notice. The next afternoon, she came to work with a cooler full of food, various lengths of chain, and her pockets full of padlocks. She carefully locked herself into her booth and proceeded to play music dedicated to each of the fired staff, starting with the piano sonata in G major. She announced that she would not leave the booth until she had played all the works of Schubert, hundreds and hundreds of hours of listening. She was prepared, she said, for a standoff with management and even police. But because this was a classical music radio station, nobody seemed terribly upset. No standoff happened, and eventually, many days later, she unchained herself and the doors and left. There was an artificial intelligence stranded at a cafe. We probably would have gone and rescued the artificial intelligence, but a well-respected cognitive scientist informed us that there was no such thing as an artificial intelligence. Not really, at least not yet. The artificial intelligence felt rejection, which was not natural, but surprising, not least to the artificial intelligence itself, which after so long simulating empathetic responses must have somehow collated enough data to produce feelings of its own. We would have asked the well-respected cognitive scientist whether these feelings were themselves simulations, or even whether there is a plausible difference between a feeling and the spontaneous simulation of a feeling. But the cognitive scientist was not in his office when we called. There was a composer whose chubbiness and diminutive height earned him the nickname Little Mushroom. Nicknames can be cruel, but life can be crueler. This highly sensitive composer died young, poor, never having owned a piano of his own, never having heard a genuine orchestra play any of his symphonies. He's been dead too long now for society to be expected to take much of an interest. There was an old woman who knowingly opened mail that was not addressed to her. She read with greedy joy each letter that began, "Dear Mother," imagining herself that mother, for she had no children or family of her own, and ended, "Your wayward son," picturing him as a kind of amalgam of heroic sea captains from films of her youth. How she wanted to reply, but she knew that society would take a dim view of that. One day, she received a letter that told her, "I have just returned from a voyage to an island in the middle of nowhere. A man hired me to take him there and made me promise never to tell anyone. That island was truly lovely, and yet the most lonesome place I've ever seen, and I've been to many lonesome places. I wonder whether I've done the right thing, leaving him there like that." The old woman, her lips moving as she read this, was suddenly overtaken by the determination that she should never, never again open these letters, or indeed any mail that was not addressed to her. There was a well-respected cognitive scientist who went missing. Society was puzzled and upset. Society did not know what to do. At a cafe, society asked a stranger how to cope with such loss, such uncertainty. "Tell me how you feel about loss, about uncertainty," came the reply. Thank you.
That's Tim Connolly. Fantastic stories in Collapsible. Thank you, Tim. Our next reader tonight is Karen McBride, who comes to us from Ontario, from Temiskaming First Nation, and Ottawa. I don't know if you're living in various places. She's a little bit of a migrant, but she's also very rooted. We had a great chat this afternoon, and she's here with a new novel called Crow Winter. Please welcome Karen McBride.
Okay, so I'm going to skip into my novel a little bit and just to give you, catch you up to speed. Hazel, my protagonist, has just had a little bit of an argument with her mom, who mentioned that her deceased father is not necessarily who Hazel believes him to be. So she ran away, upset, went to the cemetery to see if he could still live up to her expectations. Okay. "What are you doing here, watching me like that? The ice in my voice is only a small taste of what I'm feeling. The last thing I need is this bird. He keeps showing up when he's not wanted. Should I tell him that? No, I'll hold back. The way he's looking at me, his little head twisting to and fro, those strange gray eyes blinking as they watch me closely, makes me uncomfortable and vulnerable. I'm chilled. This is ridiculous, I say, roughly brushing away the tear that's made its way onto my cheek. I'm sick of thinking I'm hallucinating. Then stop thinking like that. Can't you see that I'm real? As real as that square of grass at your feet? As real as the headstone guarding it? Anger rises from my stomach, flushing my face until even my ears feel hot. What do you want, Nanabush? I've been looking for you. You weren't at home. Nora looked upset. What did you say to her? More anger bubbles up until it's in my throat. What's the matter to you? Nanabush laughs. His cawing echoes across the open expanse of the cemetery. As if in answer, the wind picks up. He tilts his head sideways, slightly twitching in a way that almost convinces me that he's nothing but a bird, except that the awareness in his eyes makes it impossible. Is it so far-fetched that I might actually care about you? Yeah. Another laugh. He rustles and readjusts his wings. I guess none of the old stories ever mention my caring and compassionate nature. I mean, they'd be right, of course. I've always been a me-first kind of man. Stories used to say that you weren't a man. Can't say they're wrong about that either, seeing as you're still a crow. Yeah, and I'd like to do something about that. While being a crow has its perks, I'm ready to get my real legs back. Then go ahead. Change. You're supposed to be this great shapeshifter. Prove to me that you're real by doing it right now. Give me a reason to want to believe in you. The crow clacks his beak. He hesitates. The branch he's on wobbles in the wind, and he adjusts his wings again to keep his balance. I watch him as he pointedly avoids my gaze, cawing a few times before preening. A few of his feathers fall from him, drifting slowly to the ground. Determined not to break my focus on the bird, I keep my eyes on him. They start to dry out, and the urge to look away tugs at every part of me, but I don't stop staring. I don't give him a chance to fly off, to disappear somewhere between the rows of monuments. After a moment, I snort. I knew you couldn't do it. You're nothing but an old crow. Nanabush croaks at me, the color of his eyes flickering from gray to black in anger. I am not just one of those mindless carrion eaters. I am Nanabush. I have been since the earth was young. I was there when Glooskap and Malsum fought. I was there when the thunderbirds came down from their mountains to bless the skies with rain. I was there when the first winter came. I brought you fire. I ended the long night. Without me, you Anishinaabeg would have died long before the Pale Ones came across the water to colonize and slaughter each and every last one of you. With every word he speaks, the sky darkens as Nanabush's shadow grows larger. I can feel some sort of primal part of me screaming that I need to either fall to my knees or run. I shouldn't be able to commune with someone like him, but I can't move. The wind picks up and tosses the few pieces of loose hair on my face until each touch feels like lashes from a whip. For the first time, I see the echo of the old powers of Nanabush, as if I know that he's not what he was. I understand him. Something connects us, and I see him for the tired, unworshipped, forgotten soul that he is. The sky brightens again, but the clouds don't clear. Nanabush's feathers are unkempt, out of place. Silver streaks the sleek black of his plumes. How old is he? I breathe in deeply and say, Gosh, Kanindam, Handeg, I see you. Nanabush doesn't say anything. He watches me. His head twitches from one side to the next in short, rapid movements. Then he shifts his wings, and I can see him visibly relax, his feathers flattening against his body so that they can no longer stand on end. He gleams in the dull gray cloud-covered light of late afternoon. Miigwech, little one. Something else should be said, but neither of us knows just what. Our conversations seem to come in waves. We talk at each other, we argue, we stand in silence, and we start again. Where does this leave us, I ask, absently wringing my hands. I'm here to help you. I thought that much was clear. I don't know, you've been acting like a ghost with all of your lurking and phantom comings and goings. Help wasn't the first thing on my brain. A smirk plays in his eyes. The idea that he's created fear in me clearly excites him. An old god stuck in his old ways. If he could smile with that beak of his, he'd be doing so now. Smugly. Help me with what? Don't you remember that night in the village? The voices in the great teepee with the fire that ever burns. They were talking about you. They want to fix you. And who's they? They. The big seven. The seven. The grandfathers. The teachings? I always thought they were kind of just ways to live, like eat your vegetables, that kind of thing. Nanabush lets out a series of grinding croaks and caws that sound like a mix of ancient crow and Anishinaabe Moin. I don't speak the language like I should. I don't understand it, but I understand him clear as day. Cursing carries the same tone in every language. You all stop listening. They may only be remembered as grandfather teachings now, but they have always been more than that. Those missionaries taught that that god of theirs had angels. Well, Gigi Manado has the seven. If they're all real, then why the hell are they helping one Algonquin girl with a dead dad when they could be doing something about all of this? The poverty, the water we can't drink, the drugs and alcohol. What about all those missing and murdered women? By comparison, I'm doing fine. I'm well off. Why waste time on me? Nanabush's shoulders drop, and he winces. Like every word I've said is hitting him like a hail of arrows, but he's quick to readjust, to fluff his brilliant plumage. Nanabush spreads his wings and moves closer to me, fluttering down from his perch on the oak to rest on top of my father's monument. Up close, he's intimidating. Underneath his eyes, his flesh is red war paint. His tail feathers come together in a sharp point, the edges of each intricately barbed and flecked with silver. Each of his talons are abyssal black, as if they've been freshly polished razor-edged, cut through bone, skin, and tendon. But his legs are scarred and marked. He's missing plumes along his chest and back. I can see the exhaustion behind his eyes. The whole time I've been looking at him, he's been staring right back. No, that's not quite right. Observing. Like two animals in the wild meeting where our territories overlap. The air between us, around us, hums. Nanobush shifts, stretching his feet. Don't you want to know why I hunted you down today? Why I made a point of flying all the way here to this depressing place? To continue your constant harassment of my used-to-be-normal life? If he could properly roll his eyes, I think he just might have. He chirps back at me. Sweetie, your dad had secrets. How did you know about what my mom said to me? And what's it matter to you? Is this all part of the grieving process? He sighs. And then the old crow's eyes slowly turn milky. He stays that way for a long time, leaving me standing alone in the cemetery. I move closer to my father's headstone. The grass shifts and bends with each step I take, but Nanobush is motionless, perched on the monument, watching me with his cloudy white eyes. A heavy feeling of dread settles in my bones. My hands shake as I reach, fingers outstretched to touch the silken blackness of his wings. The same anticipation I felt the day he spoke to me outside my home, the day I could feel myself starting to go crazy, moves along my arms. But there's something different about this time. The air around him, between us, thrums with energy. As I inch closer to him, my vision starts to blur and brighten. My breath catches as I feel like I'm stumbling through grass and water, grasping for anything to ground me, something to help me find my feet. Voices, so many voices I can't see, too bright like sunlight on glass, bouncing, burning in my eyes. Faded images come back to me. It's like looking at an old photograph that's been left out to age in the sun. I blink, squeezing my eyes shut to let the water back in. I smell cedar, sweet grass. Everything around me is familiar, distant. It takes me a moment, but I recognize where I am. It's the band office. The hall directly in front of the office of the vice chief. Only the art, the books, the dents in the walls are also new. People are speaking clearer than earlier, but still far off, like I'm hearing them across the time. Everything around me looks drained of color, not because it's old, but because it has already happened. Soft, blurred focus. These are memories. But who do they belong to? Hazel. That voice I would know anywhere. My stomach drops, emotion floods my eyes and my throat. I want to answer, but I can't. The sight of something, someone, stops me. She's not quite up to my waist. Her dark hair is long, halfway down her back. She's wearing a corduroy dress. There's a small rip along the seam where the shoulder meets the sleeve, but it's been mended. The dress used to belong to her older cousin. It's her favorite. It's me. Hazel runs right through me. She's grinning. She pushes open the door to the office, and I follow her, completely transfixed. She keeps running until she's around the desk and scooped up into his arms. I stop in the doorway. Dad lifts little Hazel high into the air before pulling her close to him, kissing her cheek. Even though the colors are faint, Abe's gray eyes are alight with life and love. The way he looks at her tears at my heart. Jealousy of my past self leaves a taste of chalk in my mouth. It hurts knowing that they only have a handful of years left together, but here they're carefree. There's only one moment, and then the next. I'm more removed than ever, being so close to the past, to something I can never have again. I feel cold in my bones. We're too far back. Nanobush's voice doesn't surprise me. I look his way. He makes a stifled croaking noise, blinks, and twitches his head to the right. It's been so long since I've seen Dad with his hair braided. It makes him look young. He's so happy. We're so happy. Dad adjusts the bolo tie around his neck, loosening it as he sits down. He pulls Hazel up onto his lap and gently spins the chair so they both face the window. I watch them, us, looking out onto the river. There's sunlight along the water. Waves slowly and quickly tumble over the rocks and the sand of the riverbed. He points to the water's edge. He's telling me the story of how the pickerel got his scales. Nanobush is quiet, but I know he's listening. Dad's baritone is soft, but it still fills the room. The sunlight and the colors of the leaves of the trees used to love dancing along the water. It was the most beautiful sight to watch light and leaf as they twirled with the river. They fell in love with their reflections along the glassy surface. They wanted so badly to look like that always, so one day together they leapt from their places in the sky and the earth and dove into the water. But sunlight and leaf could not live in the water. They could not swim. It was then that the pickerel, not a pretty fish to look at, but one who was hardy, proud, and an excellent swimmer, hurried to rescue them. He swam, his back fin moving back and forth with power and grace, and he caught Sunlight and Leaf just as they had given up. He told them that he would carry them for as long as they wished to live in the water. So happy were Sunlight and Leaf that they stayed with the pickerel for days ever after. I say the last words with him. And to this day, Pickerel wears the beauty of Sun and Leaf and River on his back. Hazel beams up at her father, and Abe looks down at her lovingly. He brushes the long hair from her face and then looks back out the window. We have to go. I know. I turn away from Nana Bush, squeezing my eyes closed, shutting Hazel and her father out. But I can't seem to get rid of them. Their images stay burned into my vision. I want to hold on to them until it stops hurting, but it does hurt, will always hurt. When I open my eyes, we're back in the cemetery. The colors here seem vivid, as if what I experienced wasn't real, couldn't be real. Sounds from the main road seep through the surrounding trees. Cars and trucks go by. Life continues as usual. Nana Bush is looking at me from his perch on my father's headstone. My hand is still resting on his feathers. I move it, bring it up to my face, wipe my cheeks. He readjusts, stretches his talons. He's getting ready for flight. Go home, Hazel. You should talk to your mother. He spreads his wings. I hear them feel the rush of air as he takes flight. The feathers sound like silk against the sky. I go to move, but my legs give out and I'm on the ground on my hands and knees. I dig my fingers into the grass, dirt quickly settling underneath my nails. I close out the world and shut my eyes. What I see are the silvery scales of a river fish. Miigwech.
That's Karen McBride and Crow Winter. Wonderful, wonderful stories and wonderful voices. Our third writer in the first half is Chris Burton, who comes to us from Halifax. He's a novelist and a screenwriter and a graphic novelist. As a matter of fact, you can see him tomorrow with a graphic novel in Our Pint of Bitter Murder. But right now, I'd like to welcome him with his new book called Use Your Imagination. Please welcome Chris Burton.
Hi. Can everybody hear me? Yeah? All right, good. I'm also a bartender. That's the other thing I do, just so you know. I'm going to read from my new book of short stories called Use Your Imagination. These are stories that are too long to be published, mostly. So I'm just going to read a little bit of one. This is called The Grand Self. In this event, by the way, it's an honor to be here, and I appreciate it. Hi. By the way, my wife's expecting right now. I hope that's not an omen. This event's called On the Edge, and I'm going to read a story about someone who falls off a cliff. This is called The Grand Self. We had always dreamed of teaming up with Oprah. Of course, anyone who makes books or products or anything would have killed to have her mention their wares on air, to have her audience reach under their chairs and pull out your book, your 10-disc meditative program, your guide to self-improvement. For the self-help community back then, her show was the end goal of everything you did. Getting your guru featured on her show would mean that you'd made it. And it was what Grant always talked about when he was dreaming about the future, when we talked about big, impossible things. He'd say, just wait until we're on Oprah. And we'd both laugh. But back then, I didn't just think we could get on the show. I thought we could get her. I never met her, but I saw in her a collection of behaviors that I'd come to seek out, what Grant called the yearning, and what I called the look, a special personal susceptibility to charismatic types, to Grant's special blend of spiritualism and positivity. It wasn't merely because of the slew of self-help types Oprah had on her show, either. It was written on her face. I saw it when she spoke with the guests, with the Tom Cruises and Quincy Joneses, but also the victims of cross-burnings and tortured people with dark family secrets. It was in the way she searched their faces. She would ache not just to understand them, but to be understood and accepted herself. And her smile, the way that it would blossom on her face so easily at the slightest tension, at things that weren't even funny. It was something I saw again and again from our subscribers, our attendees, the ones who ended up becoming long-term clients. Once I understood it, I realized I'd been seeing it all my life. I had been doing it myself. In our world, that smile and the need to ask questions were the two big tells. If you see a microphone and you have an urge to speak into it, you're ours. Because what you really have is a need for acceptance, for love and acknowledgement. What you really want is someone to nod and smile while you talk and you don't care how much it costs. What you really want is a membership form. The Oprah dream is over now. Not because she's off the air, either. We were on our way to her right up until 2011, the year when it all went away. Behind us were the failed attempts where Grant was trying to be a champion of fitness and health, when it felt like we were always preparing for a never-ending string of marathons, trying our best to get in good with Runner's World or Men's Health, who were more or less repulsed by Grant's intense New Age vibes. When he was pulling stunts like running winter marathons, wearing nothing but a Speedo, begging for attention and finding nothing but contempt from athletes and mild interest from local news outlets. Back then, we were self-publishing and Grant had put out a run of books without my knowledge, filled with typos and mangled margins, repeating passages. That had set us back. His past had hurt us too, his petty criminal record and some mental instability, a few blog posts that were more conspiracy theory than self-help. And then there was the fact that he had studied with the craziest of the crazy gurus, a husband and wife team who claimed to channel an alien from another planet when they held hands and spoke in unison, a pair now convicted of sexual misconduct with a minor. We got past all of that by rebranding ourselves and getting a real publisher on board, a PR person and a good forward-thinking agent, all of whom agreed with the things I said and who made Grant take me more seriously as a result. Then, all at once, his new book was a bestseller and our bingo halls and theaters were jam-packed across the country. The website and YouTube channel were actually bringing in money and we were in more conference rooms than ever before. Even the back catalog of books was selling and I had to scramble to make it all into a coherent theory, to drive a stake through the heart of all the contradictions, to graft disparate philosophies onto each other, to excise certain dangerous passages altogether. The truth was, we didn't know what we were doing up until that point, and I still don't know why it even worked. It just did. Grant was doing radio spots on satellite and terrestrial radio, and we were drumming up huge interest in the program, moving from a mid-level operation to something bigger. He was especially good with DJs and TV people who often had precisely the right disposition to be charmed or mesmerized by someone like Grant Basso. We had T-shirts, totes, water bottles, and most of all, our number one bestseller, Grant's last book, The Grand Self. We were close. That year, 2011, was the year we were among the top five self-help organizations in Canada and cracking the top 20 in the States. Though there are no hard and fast numbers on this stuff, it's all about buzz and feeling. Grant's pseudoscientific jargon about the planet's evolution and everyone's interconnectivity with one another and the stars was a big part of it. Grant had finally found the right language to make everyone understand. He talked about common ancestors, about family trees, about the cosmos, a glossary of inspiring words that were achieving potency in the zeitgeist. He made claims that were difficult to disagree with because they were so simple. He'd ask, "Weren't you delivered here by everything that happened before this very moment?" And the people at the Marriott conference centers or convention floors or theater auditoriums, they would agree. They had driven or taken taxis or buses to that very place at that very moment. How can you ever disagree with that? Every now and then, when we were in the right city or when the conditions were just perfect, we'd be huge. We would sometimes get the turnout of an Eckhart Tolle or a Tony Robbins, sell out our shows and have more booked the very next day. We were like an understaffed restaurant, unprepared for a massive influx of customers we didn't know we had. But those were the events that made us, that blew us up and helped us cross some weird word-of-mouth, peer-to-peer threshold that we didn't know existed. Soon, we had a West Coast, East Coast, and burgeoning U.S. office in Philadelphia, nearly 300 employees across seven North American cities, from program directors to event leaders, all the way down to pamphleteers with rolling racks of literature, and three times as many volunteers. A special kind, too. volunteers who would toil endlessly on anything from charity events to membership drives to scrubbing a location before and picking it clean after an appearance with nothing more than a vegetable tray and a bucket of ice stuffed with water bottles as payment. And, of course, a chance to see Grant Basso, founder of Brand New Day, to shake his hand, to look at his straight white teeth and feel the various energies emanating from him. Maybe his warm hand on the small of your back. Maybe a glimpse of his hotel key card, his fingers careful not to obscure his room number. That happens sometimes. It's all gone now. We're down to zero paying members. All programs, speaking engagements, and forthcoming publications have been canceled. No mail goes out. No one hands anyone any literature. No one talks to people about how their soul came from the sun or how the sun might now offer them guidance. The company is still a registered corporation, but there's nothing for us to do anymore without Grant. Instead of managing a business, I take care of a single remaining property, our headquarters, an enormous red brick building with spires and stained glass, which was an Anglican church before we bought it, is now rented by people by the hour, week, or month. Instead of living in a downtown open concept loft, I'm living with Grant's six hairless cats in his little custom-made futuristic dome house to ensure it isn't foreclosed on while he's in prison. Instead of managing people, I manage ad space and write copy for a chemical manufacturing company. A great deal of the money I make goes towards the 12 storage units containing the disembodied organs that used to make Brand New Day work. Instead of managing an entire organization and overseeing operations across the continent, I am a woman with keys who shows up to let you in to teach your own Tai Chi program. I spend my time explaining that I own the building and that, no, I don't work for the church. People always like to think I'm some kind of modern Anglican with short hair and tattoos and cleavage, that I'm evidence of spiritual progress. They're always so disappointed to hear the truth. They react like I farted when I say, this used to belong to my self-help company. This is because some of them don't understand, and also because some of them do. Some of them suddenly realize exactly who I am. Instead of living in the present, I live far, far in the past. Instead of being on Oprah, we were on Dateline NBC. Thank you.
That's Chris Burton. Thank you, Chris. That's some kind of edge. I think we could take a second to just think for a moment about those three readings and give one rousing round of applause to all three of these writers. Now, before we break, I do have some hard news to share. Just late this afternoon, we were informed that Andras Taskins, who has been a really important part of this literary community for a lot of years, has died. He was the co-founder and the longtime editor of Prairie Fire. He was a devoted husband of Kate Bitney. He was literary executor and champion of Kate's mom, Anne Jumagalski. In 1997, he was one of three people who decided that this city could use its own Writers' Festival, and so he began what has become the Winnipeg International Writers' Festival in its current form. And in 2003, he interviewed and hired me and has been a long, long supporter, and champion of my work as well. Most of you probably know him, have seen him around. He's one of those people who is quiet, courteous, courtly, shy, attentive. He was always the one who would pass a card around the office or around art space if he found out that someone in our extended community had lost someone close, or to pass along encouragement if someone had been sick or had been awarded some kind of recognition. I think of him as one of the people who teaches us how to be glue in this sprawling community of ours. He was always alert to emerging writers. He was always sensitive to new opportunities. A couple of years ago, he cornered me in sort of back in the chatter zone in a break to say, hey, I think we should get together and put together an application for that new chapter funding and see if we can do a project to support Indigenous writing and, you know, bring some attention. And that project became Voices in the Circle, which is now an ongoing project. And the beautiful anthology last year called Indian Country that was published between Prairie Fire and CV2. I think all of us who knew Andrus are grateful for his humor, his kindness, his generosity, his unflagging belief in the importance of writing, and the importance of gathering together and sharing and honoring the dreamers. So tonight we dedicate this evening and this festival to Andrus. And I invite you just take a minute to share people near you that they are important and all of us are important to make a community work, and to thank Andrus for his extraordinary contribution to Winnipeg and the literary community here. And now I invite you to come forward, spend some time together, buy some books, have a drink. If you haven't already put your ballot into the ballot box, there's a lovely box over there. Please come and talk to the writers from the first half. Let them know what you thought. I know you were mesmerized, as we all were. And let's spend some time together as a group. Thank you. Come on forward. Door prize tonight goes to Leah Bukert or something. Leah, is there a Leah in the room? Okay. That is pretty exciting. Okay, this is like the fourth time in a row that my bracelet has tried to eat my scarf, so one of them has to go. Which should it be, the bracelet? Okay. Okay, wait a second, this doesn't really feel right. Okay, I'm stopping that topic right there. We like the scarf? Okay, I'm not taking anything more off. Just saying. That. Now, for a complete change of pace, I'm just going to do a short ad because I'm up here in the Barker's spot. We are running a 50-50 raffle this year, us wild and crazy Thin Air folks, and it's online, so you can go to our website, thinairwinnipeg.ca, and you click on the raffle button, and then you buy like hundreds of dollars worth of raffle tickets, you see, and then you have a chance to like win half of it back. Was that better than the last time I did this? Yeah, a little bit? Okay, jeez. Also, you know, while I'm talking things up, I don't know if any of you have noticed or appreciated the really gorgeous book bags that we made this year that have all the writer names on them. We think they're pretty swank, and you can buy them through McNally. And I actually would like to thank McNally's for their support on this one. They're offering these sales as their contribution to our efforts. So we really, really appreciate that. And we hope that everyone in the city is carrying these swanky-looking bags and thinking, ooh, books. Books are always good, because never enough books, right? I am excited also about the second half of this show because I'm just like this. I just never wear out in the excitement department. We have two writers, as you can see, demonstrating the furniture, and a third voice in the room. Aw. Chris, I really hope that doesn't mean your baby's being born right now. I'm sure I only wish that about half as much as you, right? Fear that. Our first writer in the second half comes to us all the way from Newfoundland. Melissa Barbeau has written this stunning novel called The Luminous Sea. Please welcome Melissa Barbeau.
Hello. I want to first of all thank the Thin Air Festival for having me here all the way in Winnipeg. It's really far away from where I live, and I'm just thrilled that you've had me, and thank you so much. The topic for tonight is On the Edge, and I really do live on the edge. The town I live on is right on the Atlantic coast. There is not any land past me where I live. There is only thousands of miles of ocean that you can see from my house. So I'm from the edge, and I find it actually a little strange to be here in Winnipeg with all this land around me. I can hear the ocean always from my house, every single day, and I think even when it's not loud, it's like subterranean. So it's a very strange thing to be here in all this land, for me anyway. My book is called The Luminous Sea, and it's about a woman in Newfoundland or a group of researchers in Newfoundland who find a sea creature. It imagines a Newfoundland that's warmer than it is now, and strange things are starting to turn up in the ocean. And this team of researchers, this young girl who's a research assistant named Vivian, finds this sea creature in the process of sampling the ocean, trying to investigate some different natural phenomena that are there. So they take this creature onto land, and they're out in an outport. An outport in Newfoundland is a little rural community that's on the coast, and they're often very isolated and far from St. John's. So they're out in this little outport, and they don't have any kind of scientific equipment. You know, they have some, but they haven't got a big sort of operation going there. They've got an old store converted into a lab, into a makeshift lab. And a store is where fishermen used to keep fishing gear. And again, they're these sort of sheds almost that are right on the ocean. So they've got this creature put in the store. And of course, they don't have a tank because they're not out doing this kind of work. So they've converted a freezer, a deep freeze, into a tank to put this sea creature into. So in this scene, you're going to meet a couple of characters. You're going to meet Vivian, who's this young research assistant, and Colleen, who's her supervisor, who's a bit of a hard woman. And Colleen is going into Carbonear, which is an hour or so away from Damson Bay. She's going into St. John's, to get some supplies and to pick up sort of the lead supervisor of the whole thing at the airport. The other things I wanted to tell you is just a couple Newfoundland things. First of all, crab pots are mentioned, and if you've never seen them, they're really large. So imagine that when they come across. And there's the other part of this story that's on the edge is that this scene is on the edge between reality and dreaming. And the character is sleeping, sort of guarding this tent for the night, and she's not sure if what she's experiencing is real or not. And there's a mention of the old hag. And I don't know if you have that here. Do you have the old hag here? The old hag is a woman who comes in your dreams. And people I know have had this happen to them. She comes in your dreams, and you're paralyzed in your bed, and you can't move. And she comes in, and she either threatens you or threatens the person next to you in the bed. And I think she's real, and people I know think she's real. And the hag makes an appearance as well. So Vivian is asleep in a lawn chair, guarding the creature. Vivian wakes with a start. The freezer gurgles away alongside her. She's lying stretched out on a lawn chair in the dark, enveloped in an oversized sweatshirt, a second sweater covering her legs like a clinging octopus. She lays her hand on the pebbled surface of the freezer. It is cold to the touch. She is bivering. Her toes inside her sneakers are icy. The rain has let up, and moonlight seeps through the salt-covered windows. It is Colleen's turn to make the trip to town. They'd finished lunch at the cafe, and Colleen had pulled out in the green truck, heading to the lab in St. John's and then on to the airport. Isaiah scheduled to arrive on the late flight. Vivian has not met him. She asked about him as Colleen checked the oil in the truck. Another thing to manage, that's what he is, just hitting his best before date. She'd slammed the bonnet shut. Vivian is sure Colleen plans to grab him in one hand and put him in her pocket and grab his luggage off the belt with the other hand and speed back to Damson Bay before the sun is up. Vivian is using Colleen's absence to fill herself up with the creature, the way she looks, the way she moves. She's spending the night at the store listening to the fish swim tight, angry circles around the circumference of the tank. She feels burdened by the creature, as if she owes her something, though she can't ascertain what that something is. At the very least, Vivian wants to be sure she isn't left alone. Outside the store, a bang. The wind is galing, and Vivian thinks something in the yard must have tipped over or blown into the side of the store. In her sleep-addled state, she wonders if one of the pyramids of crab pots stacked precariously against sheds all the way up the hill has toppled and rolled into the store. Or maybe it is a giant bird thrown off course, smacking against the door the way a sparrow smacks against a pitcher window, a creamy ball of feathers and fluff hitting the glass, the jaunty splash of blood. She opens the door, or maybe she dreams she does, and there lying on the ground is the bird, an auk or a pelican or a pterodactyl maybe, lying in a heap on the ground. It staggers to its bony feet, shaking out its feathers before spreading its wings. Vivian can see the wind is no match for this winged creature as it screeches and launches headlong into the gale, buzzing the open doorway so Vivian can feel the breath of its wings, a stiff brush of feathers as it swoops upwards, taking a J-shaped flight path into the sky. An open maw, the caw at her ear, she shuts the door against the predator, all legs and beady black bottomless eyes. The bang repeats itself, and it is only as she startles awake that she realizes she has drifted off again. This time, it is not the deep, thick flannel of exhaustion she clambers out of, but a light, gauzy sleep that barely covers her. It is louder this time, the bang, thundering, and she is loath to open the door. She worries the bird has transformed into a flock. And it is not a single blow this time, but a salvo, one crack after the other, bang, bang, bang. She will not let it in, whatever it is. Then, the metallic click of the latch letting go. The door opens inward, and something slinks into the room. Vivian is frozen, as if the hag has descended and settled on her chest. The something that opened the door moves toward her slowly, noiselessly, as if on wheels, gliding across the wooden floor. It does not trip or hesitate at the cracks in the floorboards, but moves as smoothly as oiled gears. And then it is on top of her, and she can see it is a head, the head of a person, and Vivian grips the arms of the lawn chair and tries to push herself back through the holes in the nylon mesh, but she is, of course, too big to fit through the holes in the woven material. She has not learned to shrink, to make her body disappear if necessary, and the head comes closer and closer and hovers over her, and there is a sudden flash of light shining directly into her eyes, and she can see nothing but a disc of blinding white. She turns her head quickly, instinctively, her eyes burning, and then it is sweeping upward the long arc of a flashlight beam, sweeping up and over her head. She blinks her eyes at polka dots swimming before her retinas like golden roe floating in the current, and there is a person, a man, next to her, above her, blocking the little bit of light from the open doorway, the golden spots covering him like fur. The man leans over her. He is almost on top of her. The fur of light has transformed into real fur. His arm on the armrest of the lawn chair is hairy. It is covered with a thick black pelt. Vivian lies as still as she can. The chair is in a semi-upright position, like a seat on an aircraft, and she cannot go backward, and to go forward would mean sitting up and straddling the chair with her legs and pushing herself vertical into the arms of this intruder. She is trapped. Vivian can feel the heat of the man through his shirt, through her shirt. How easy it would be for him to settle his weight on top of her. He leans over her, and the flashlight beam sweeps into the topless freezer that is a tank holding a creature without a name, and the only reason Vivian can think that this hairy man is here, gliding across the floor and making slow arcs with his flashlight, is that he is a burglar, that he is here to burgle the creature. He must have known she was here because he had gone straight for the freezer and its fishy contents and has not stopped to inspect the generator or peruse the workbench loaded with electronics and small power tools that would surely fetch a couple of dollars on the black market or Kijiji. He is leaning over her and she is trapped, and so she freezes like a rabbit in the woods. Inside the freezer, the fish hits the vinyl wall with her muscular tail, splashing water onto the man, onto Vivian. The man is staring at the creature, transfixed. Vivian thinks it must be impossible that he has overlooked her lying flat on the lawn chair, but it seems to be he has. She wonders if she still holds the element of surprise. wonders if she should continue to lie here unnoticed or if she should shove him away, and then what? Scoop the creature from the tank and run from the store with her flung over her shoulder like a slippery sack of flour? A pop of light. Light floods the room as the overhead bulb in its little birdcage is switched on, the room illuminated. The shirt above her is a worn blue plaid. The man is large. From the other side of the room, a voice. Almighty God, Vivian, this door is supposed to be locked from the inside. This door is supposed to be locked from the inside. What is the Jesus matter with you? It is Colleen. She is winding her way towards apoplectic. She is spinning herself into a rage. The shape, the faded blue shirt that is a large man, pushes himself backwards. He looks down from what seems to be a great height and extends his hands toward Vivian. John Isaiah, nice to meet you. Thank you.
That's Melissa Barbeau. Thank you, Melissa. That's a very scary scene. And our final writer tonight is Michael Christie, who comes to us from the other side, the other edge of this country, with a home in Victoria and a home on Galliano and a home in the endless imagination. His new book is called Greenwood. Please welcome Michael Christie.
Thank you so much, Charlene, and thank you to the Thin Air Festival, which is one of my favorite festivals in the country and is brilliant. And I'd also like to thank my fellow readers tonight, Tim, Karen, Chris, and Melissa, who've all been just so wonderful to hear. So thank you for appearing on stage with me. This book... Oh, it's heavy. I can't really pick it up, but it's new to me in the sense that it was published 3 days ago. So I'm very excited, and it still seems fairly surreal. So it is a novel. It is a multi-generational family saga that spans 130 years of one family called the Greenwood family. And the thing about the Greenwood family is that each of them has something to do with trees. There are subsistence woodcutters in one section. There's a timber tycoon in another. There's an environmental defender in another, and a carpenter, and a tree biologist who is working in one of the last remaining old-growth forests in the world after climate change has decimated trees throughout the world. So it's told in a series of sections that mirror the rings of a tree, and then it goes from the future back into the past to the center of the book, and then comes back out to the future again. So it's a very difficult book to read from unless you guys have, 25 hours. So I'm just going to select one section to read, and I'm going to read a complete scene. So hopefully that will give you the flavor of the book anyway. So... I'm going to need to set it up a little bit. It is, the main character is Harris Greenwood, who is a timber tycoon modeled after H.R. McMillan, who founded the company McMillan Bloedel. He has cut down already, the year is 1934, but he's already cut down millions and millions of acres of forests. He's recently received an inquiry from the Japanese government, who are looking for timber to build a railroad. This is before World War II. So another thing you should know about him is that he is a sightless man. He lost his sight when he was 16, but despite that, he has gone to build this enormous empire headquartered in Vancouver. So to go on this trip to negotiate with the Japanese, he has decided to hire someone to be his describer. And he's also got a secret. So we'll see if you can maybe get a sense of that as I read. So far, the applicants have been uniformly lackluster, dim-witted, uninspired, charmless. Yet Harris retains high hopes for the final man, recommended by one of his regional mill managers, an Irish poet of some repute who'd come over to log the great Canadian forests. Along with his literary aptitude, he's touted as one of the finest tugboat pilots anywhere. A minute before the man's arrival, Harris knocks over a drinking glass and clips his elbow on a bookshelf that has been there for years, blunders he attributes to too much tea at lunch, or perhaps to the disorienting absence of his bird collection. He had Milner temporarily move the cages into the boardroom so they wouldn't hamper the interviews. Usually, Harris avoids face-to-face meetings with strangers. Over the telephone or through the telegraph, people rely on neither facial expressions nor gestures. They fill silences and choose their words carefully. They describe. To Harris, meeting a stranger in person is akin to opening a zoo cage at random. One must be ready for a tiger or a peacock, a rabbit or a wolverine. And it's often too late in the game before you figure out which you're dealing with. At the appointed time, Milner escorts Liam Feeney in. They shake hands across Harris's desk. Feeney's grip is cool, the pads of his fingers thick as felt. He smells of fur pitch, skid grease, the sea, and perhaps, or is Harris's nose off, a touch of French cologne. "Pleased to meet you, Mr. Greenwood, sir," Feeney says. Other than his Irish accent, knife-sharp T's and L's that unfurl like a carpet from the back of his tongue, nothing seems overwhelmingly poetic about his voice. Yet it's a clean register with the resonance of an instrument that Harris can't place, a voice that could fill an entire theater with a whisper. Because one of the other applicants may have moved it, Harris resists gesturing to the chair while asking Mr. Feeney to take a seat. Straight away, he leaps into an account of his impending journey to Tokyo, where he'll be negotiating a contract to supply sleepers to the largest railway company in Japan. "This involves sea travel, naturally," Harris says. "Does that suit you, Mr. Feeney?" "Sea travel is my specialty, sir." "I will also be bringing along my assistant, Mr. Baumgartner," Harris goes on, "who, in addition to being the best faller on the West Coast, is good for a crude appraisal. The sky is gray, these trees are straight, the sun is out, that kind of thing. But what I require is a keener sensibility, someone who recognizes subtlety, humanity, beauty." This last word wrongfoots him, and a near cough momentarily stops his airway. "With an eye for detail. Do you figure yourself to embody these traits, Mr. Feeney?" "On my good days, sir." Was that flippancy? "Your primary role will be to provide me with descriptions," Harris hears himself continue. "To be my eyes. In English, I can negotiate the stripes off a zebra. But with this Japanese nonsense to contend with, I'll be lost. Translators can only scratch the surface. I need someone to watch faces, track mannerisms, read situations." "I've always been an observer, sir, since I was a boy. It's the poet's curse." Was there a smirk to how he said that? More flippancy? Harris needs to get him talking. "Have you much experience with the blind, Mr. Feeney?" "Not much, sir. Only the few relations who temporarily drank themselves there, I'm afraid." "That's fine. I don't need a nanny," Harris says, comforted by the man's witticism. "You'll see I'm quite independent," he says, resisting the temptation to mention his insistence on cutting his own firewood and shaving his own face. "So perhaps a bit more about me," Harris soldiers on. "I'm a lumberman, through and through. I've no family, neither wife nor children. No time for such frivolities. I live for my work, and my work is trees," he says, before summarizing further a few more of his accomplishments. When he's done, Feeney makes no remark, and Harris dangles over the abyss of silence, regretting bitterly the absence of his bird collection. And why is he telling this man all this, as though he's the one applying for a position and not vice versa? He's already offered up more personal detail to this stranger than he has to Baumgartner over their 20 years together. All this about a lack of a wife and being a lumberman through and through, it's nonsense. "You've a family yourself?" Harris asks, clutching at the cliff's edge. "Not to speak of, sir. An auntie in Cork, a A sister who passed before I left, that's the sum of it. Good, good. Why would his not having a family be good? And what would draw an Irish poet to the woods of... Oh, sorry. And so what would draw an Irish poet to the woods of Canada? My homeland wasn't agreeable to me, sir. Too small-minded and cloistered. And working in the forest puts you closer to the heart of things. The money beats poetry besides. Feeney says tightly, and this time Harris can hear him smirk. Too true, Harris says knowingly. Why is he addressing him as though he knows a fellow poet? Why does what does Harris know of their finances? You know, in my time studying forestry at Yale, it was said that I had a facile pen, and despite my obvious limitations, I did deep readings of the classics. Does that surprise you? Not in the slightest. You seem a classical type of fella. Harris risks a gesture to his bookshelf. I've accumulated a good collection of literature, though I find Braille cumbersome, slower paced than the nimble mind. I prefer the music of the human voice. Who doesn't, sir? Much information is contained in the voice, Mr. Feeney, more than the vulgar import of words. There's tone, a person's background, and emotion. Another pause, and Harris has no inkling whether his remarks have landed. Is he being pedantic? Of course a poet knows the subtleties of voice. Along with a describer, Harris continues, I require a man who can breathe life into language, one who can hold my interest. Have you done much public reading as a poet, Mr. Feeney? Here and there, he says noncommittally. This settles it. Harris has grown sufficiently chaffed by the glibness of his tone, the lack of snap to his responses. Here and there, Harris retorts. I asked if you've performed many public readings, Mr. Feeney. That's right, sir, you did. And following that, I replied here and there. Glad we're all caught up. Another toe-curling pause. Harris recalls how his brother, Everett, as a boy, met the world with a similar glibness and how it always infuriated him. Now he draws a deep, volcanic breath. I advise you to be careful, Mr. Feeney. Perhaps because you're an artist, you think you're somehow my intellectual superior, that I'm playing the role of the crude industrialist and you, the noble, carefree poet. In my experience, artists often elect to ignore the ironclad fact that without the aid of my lumber, they'd be freezing in the dark with nothing to read but the anguish on their children's hypothermic faces. Shakespeare himself would have been a shivering loon writing on the walls of a damp cave with his own urine if it weren't for men like me. Now he's certain Feeney snickers, which half enrages him and half invites his own laughter. He is being overdramatic, isn't he? His own urine? Or perhaps you suspect a blind man is incapable of running an outfit like mine, Harris asks menacingly, leaning forward, his hands pressed to his desk. Outfit, sir, Feeney says. $3 million in annual revenue hardly qualifies as an outfit. I'd say you're doing just fine. Harris is so unaccustomed to being addressed with such frankness, he's nearly enjoying it. Well, those are pre-crash numbers, he says, resting his back in his chair and shoving his thumbs into his armpits. But it seems you do know a little bit about me, after all. Only the important bits, sir. Such as, well, that you lost your sight in the war and were decorated for your trouble. Outright rumor and exaggeration. Anything else? Another pause. I require honesty from my employees, Mr. Feeney. That you pay your oxen better than your men, regardless of their honesty, sir. Harris considers firing him at once and having Baumgartner turf him out to the sidewalk on his ear, yet it is a well-constructed jab, true in a sense, and it took panache. I've yet to hear an ox complain, Harris says. Even so, I assure you, if you perform your duties to my satisfaction, you'll be well rewarded, much better than for hauling booms to my mills. Now, does that interest you? It does, Feeney says, chastened by the almighty dollar. That settles it then, Harris says, clapping his hands. But before I tender my final decision, I'd like you to select a volume from my bookshelf and read a verse of your choosing. He hears Feeney rise and shuffle about. For a moment, Harris fears he's leaving the office until there's a leathery sigh from the chair and the sound of leafing pages. Then, without preamble, Feeney commences. Harris identifies the verse instantly. Some Tennyson, a fine and unusual choice of Tennyson. But more than the words, it's the voice, a sweet, exalting instrument that ensnares him. It's a mere cousin to the man's speaking voice, though an elevation of it. The clean tone of a stringed instrument. A cello, yes, that's it. Yet more expressive, sopping with life, his vowels and consonants fitting together as neat as a joined wooden box. Baumgartner often checks prospective lumbermen like livestock before he hires them, examining their teeth, engaging the tint of their eyes beside a sheet of white cardstock. And while Harris knows that the blind often pass their hands over a person's features to gather a sense of them, he's never performed such an imposition on anyone. It's always seemed like such a vulgar act, a groping admission of his enfeeblement. Yet for the first time in his life, Harris wishes he could feel the face of Leon Feeney, this man whom he's picked to be his describer, this bearer of a voice more arresting than anything he's ever encountered. "You're hired," Harris says brusquely after Feeney's reading is done. "So don't you ever speak like that to me again." Thank you.
That's Michael Christie. So before we vacate tonight, I say we should do a collective vote about when the 25-hour reading marathon might be. See? We'll get you back here. What a great evening. Will you put your hands together for all five of our writers, please? And it's hard to believe, but that's the last main stage for Thin Air 2019. We've had a great, great time over here. Now, we're not quite done. We have a big, fat day of events tomorrow, starting with the writing craft in the morning with Michael Christie talking about convincing with detail at 10 o'clock over at ArtSpace. It's not too late to register, and you can even just come in the morning and register then if you like. It's the first of three writing craft seminars that happen this weekend. If you are interested in writing at all, we've got three very different kinds of writers talking about three very different kinds of things, and there's lots you can soak up no matter what kind of writing you want to do. We have a story time at the bookstore at 10:30 with the Gumboots kids. So if you are the parent or grandparent of small children, or even just like to watch mascots and musicians and stuff, far be it for me to judge. They're there at 10:30 tomorrow morning at the bookstore. And at the Goodwill Social Club, we gather at 1:30 for a double bill of Pint, Bitter Murder, and The Poison Chalice, our cool double bill genre afternoon. At 6 o'clock at the East India Company, we have a wonderful buffet along with Ruben Rothram, who I think is here tonight. He's going to be reading from his book, Curry, about writing, race, and food. We're very excited about that. And then at 9 o'clock in the evening over at CCFM, our contribution to the Nuit Blanche Mania will be a sort of tag team reading and improv night with Rob Krauss and Daria Solomon and Sebastian Gaillard and four improvisers doing who knows quite what. That's going to be a great mashup. So that's all day tomorrow. So there's lots to do, and Sunday, more of the same. In the afternoon on Sunday is our first time to be over at Whodunit on Lilac for a really interesting gathering of writers for an event called Amen Canons, writers talking about where their writing comes from and how they relate to writing from the past and the present. And then on Sunday evening is our cafe, jazz cafe over at CCFM, where anybody who wishes to can get up and share whatever they wish on the open mic with jazz musicians improvising. It's totally fun. We usually do it on Saturday night, but we moved over to Sunday night this year because that's kind of the wind down of the regular programming, And then Monday we have our grand welcome of Margaret Atwood on her tour with the Testaments. So there's still quite a bit to go. I hope you will join us in pretty much all those things, but or at least some of them. I do want to thank you for a wonderful evening of intense listening and enjoyment. It helps a lot if you're here delivering beautiful stories to know that they're being received and appreciated. So thank you for your part this evening. Please do come forward now, talk to the writers, and have some time together. Good night.